From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Most Americans know stories of Vietnam vets who could not quite shake the after effects of war, the night sweats, the violent outbursts, and maybe worst of all, the deep and lingering emotional numbness. All told, more than 30% of U.S. soldiers returning from Vietnam suffered symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The rates among soldiers returning from later engagements have been far lower, hovering around 10% until now. A new U.S. Army study published this month in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that up to 17% of U.S. combat soldiers returning from Iraq suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, or anxiety, by far the highest rate since Vietnam. And despite the Army's efforts to help these soldiers, fewer than half of those diagnosed with psychological problems go on to seek help, often for fear of being stigmatized as weak. That fear is greatest, the report found, among soldiers most in need of treatment. Tonight on Point, the psychological price of war, post-traumatic stress disorder, and U.S. combat troops returning from Iraq. Are you back from the front and grappling with demons, with post-traumatic stress? Do you have a husband, a wife, son, or daughter who has brought the war in Iraq home and is having trouble? What do we owe America's returning veterans? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Silver Spring, Maryland, is Colonel Charles Hoag, a psychiatrist at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. Charles Hoag was lead author in the Institute's recent study of post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. combat soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, published in the July 1st New England Journal of Medicine. Good evening and welcome, Colonel Charles Hoag.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also joining me tonight from Woodstock, Vermont, is Matthew Friedman, Executive Director of the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and a professor of psychiatry, pharmacology, and toxicology at Dartmouth Medical School. He's treated war veterans for 30 years and continues to see soldiers, including Iraq vets, 4 days a week at the U.S. military's main PTSD Treatment Center. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Matthew Friedman.
Good evening.
Thanks to both for being with us. Colonel Hoag, you are co-author of the big new study on post-traumatic stress disorder coming out of Iraq. Tell us how you gathered your information and what have you found?
Well, it was survey-based research. We conducted surveys among soldiers and Marines just prior to leaving for Iraq or after coming back from duty in Iraq or Afghanistan. We had over 6,000 service members included in our study. And basically, we found that about 15 to 17% of the service members had symptoms of depression, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress upon return from Iraq, and a lower percent among after return from Afghanistan. These rates are, it's important to point out, are rates generated by self-report surveys that are anonymous in nature, and many service members do relatively well with their with the symptoms that they're reporting. So these are not clinical diagnoses, but does represent, I think, an accurate reflection of the percent of service members coming back from Iraq who are at risk for mental health concerns.
And what does that number, 15 to 17% out of Iraq, less in Afghanistan, but the Iraq number, what does it tell you about the conflict in Iraq and the impact it's having on servicemen? How do you look at that? How do you assess it?
Well, our study was focused exclusively on combat arms units that were actively engaged in the initial ground war in Iraq. So this is not a representative sample of all service members who have served over there. But certainly is representative of the combat infantry units engaged in the initial ground operations. And it's clear that service members who participated in these operations had significant combat experiences, and there is there are psychological effects that can occur due to that.
We're going to look at exactly what those are and what generates those effects. But Matthew Friedman, you've written in an editorial accompanying the piece in the New England Journal of Medicine that this study, you say, forces us to acknowledge the psychiatric cost of sending young men and women to war. You say it's possible that these early findings underestimate the eventual magnitude of the clinical problem. And you call this report unprecedented. Why? How?
Well, it is unprecedented. I think that that Dr. Hogue and his colleagues deserve a great deal of credit for getting this done. Well, first of all, this is the first time that we've ever had this kind of information so early in the game at a time when we were still actually in the war zone. Furthermore, the fact that we have data, that, as Dr. Hogue mentioned, before deployment so that we can actually differentiate between what were the symptom levels before deployment and after, which makes it much more likely that whatever changes we've seen were due to the experiences that happened in the war zone in Iraq or in Afghanistan. So I think that those are very, very important aspects. And I think the final thing, which you alluded to in your introductory comments, is the fact that that this paper really points out the magnitude of stigma, the importance that stigma is really preventing people who need treatment from coming in for treatment. And ironically, unlike in the post-Vietnam era, we've got treatments that work. We have excellent treatments if people will just come in and let us do what we're capable of doing.
We want to look at those, but first let me ask you, Colonel Hogue, Dr. Hogue, what's the Army's interest in doing this study and in putting the results out? What are you hoping to gain by it?
This study has been supported from the very beginning by senior leadership in Army and Navy leadership, Marine leadership, DOD leadership. In trying to understand, the military is really very interested in understanding the psychological effects of serving in Afghanistan and Iraq, so that we can best provide services to our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are coming home. So that's really the purpose of this study, is to garner information to help us provide the very best care that we can to service members coming back.
And maybe to let them know they're not alone and they ought to come in and get treatment if they need it.
I think that's as Dr. Friedman pointed out, is probably the most important finding from this study, is that a large portion of the service members who expressed mental health concerns on the surveys did not seek any help, and mostly this appeared to be due to perceptions that they would be stigmatized if they did, that they may be treated differently by their unit or viewed differently by their peers or their leadership in the unit. And this really provides us with information, important information, for trying to develop programs to help service members when they come back, soldiers and Marines.
Matthew Friedman, can you describe for us, we've got flip phrases that we reel off, but what is post-traumatic stress disorder? How is it generated and how is it exhibited? What are the symptoms?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is just the newest name for something that's been around for a long time. But since 1980, the American Psychiatric Association defined post-traumatic stress disorder. And in point of fact, there are four different major criteria for the diagnosis. First of all, you have to have been in a situation where your life was threatened, or loss of limb, or someone else was that you loved or nearby was threatened. Obviously, being in a war zone would meet that criterion, and you had to have responded to that dangerous situation with a very intense emotional response, which the American Psychiatric Association talks about as fear, helplessness, or horror. There are other strong emotions as well. The second cluster of symptoms is in many ways the most unique aspect of PTSD, in that the traumatic event has a life of its own, will go on forever. We know concentration camp survivors from the Nazi Holocaust or prisoners of war from the Second World War still have these symptoms, and they include traumatic nightmares. They include rethinking about the experience during the day. You're trying to listen to this radio program, and you can't stop thinking about what happened in Fallujah a couple of weeks ago.
And it can go on for a lifetime, you're saying?
Well, yes, there is. For some people, it can go on for a lifetime. That's untreated. You have to remember all of our data about World War II, prisoners of war, and Holocaust survivors was developed on people before we really had good treatments for PTSD. The development of good treatments is a very recent development within the last 10 years. So, yes, there are Holocaust survivors, World War II veterans who still have PTSD as intense as it was back in the 1940s or 1930s. Yes, absolutely.
So when it comes to returning combat soldiers from Iraq, you're treating soldiers who have come back from Iraq, soldiers who are suffering from PTSD. What kind of stories are you hearing? Where are their where did they meet their traumas? What kind of dynamic is hitting them hardest?
Well, it varies because you have to remember that, we're all different and we all bring a different experiences and expectations to whatever situation we're confronted with, whether it's in a war zone or being raped or in an assault or in a natural disaster. For some people, the events that are most frightening are, being under conventional warfare. Many people who were not necessarily combatants, as were in Dr. Hoag's study, but truck drivers, medical personnel who were attacked by car bombs or terrorist attacks. For some people, the most terrible event is witnessing civilian casualties and being unable to do it, or even feeling that they themselves had inadvertently contributed to the death or injuries of civilians, particularly children. So the events themselves can vary considerably, but what they all have in common is that the person who experienced them, feels very, very bad about it, feels that he or she should have died instead of someone else, that he was full of fear or horror about what happened, and that the event won't go away. They go to sleep, and there's a nightmare about the event waiting for them. They see reminders of the event, even a newscast, and they're suddenly back in the event in their own minds and emotionally. One of the things that people do, because these memories are so intolerable, they're just so unbearable, is that they come up with a number of different strategies to avoid having to confront these symptoms. They'll avoid anything that might remind them of the event. They'll shut down emotionally. You mentioned that in your introduction also.
The numbness.
The numbness. In many ways, the numbness may be the most serious symptom of all, because when you shut down keep yourself from experiencing the fear, the guilt, the horror, you also shut down your capacity to have loving feelings, to have enjoyment. And that's why marriages and relationships are a major casualty of PTSD, because the person is unable to respond emotionally. They're wooden. They're like automatons. And it's a terrible way to go through life.
Charles Hogue, let me ask you, do the men and women coming back from Iraq know when they have these problems? Do they recognize it, or do their family members recognize it?
Well, I thought that was one of the most interesting things about Dr. Hogue's study was, unlike in earlier wars, it appeared that people did recognize that they were having these symptoms, and did recognize that these symptoms were getting in their way, either in terms of their personal lives or in terms of their professional lives. But in spite of that knowledge, they were unwilling to come in for treatment. We know about PTSD now, not just in the military and the veteran setting, but I think that the whole September 11th aftermath, I think, sensitized the whole American civilian community, as well as the military and veteran community, about PTSD and about what the symptoms might be like.
And yet returning vets from Iraq not coming in anything like the numbers who are, in fact, affected. Matthew Friedman, Charles Hogue, please stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the psychological price of a war, about post-traumatic stress disorder and U.S. troops returning from Iraq. You can join the conversation. Are you back from the front and grappling with demons, with post-traumatic stress? Do you have a husband, a wife, a son, a daughter who's brought the war in Iraq home and is having trouble? Can you imagine being under fire in Baghdad 1 month and Home with the Kids the next. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the psychological price of a war, about post-traumatic stress disorder, and U.S. troops returning from Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. Soldiers, what did you see in Iraq, and how are you dealing with it? What is the country's obligation to the hearts and minds of returning vets? And what did we learn from Vietnam? Have we acted sufficiently on what we've learned? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Silver Spring, Maryland, by Colonel and Dr. Charles Hoge. He's psychiatrist at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research and principal author of a recent Army study entitled Combat Duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, Mental Health Problems and Barriers to Care. We're also joined from Woodstock, Vermont, by Matthew Friedman, executive director of the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. And right now, from the studios of KAZU in Pacific Grove, California, Dan Baum joins us. He's author of The Price of Valor, a terrific article in this week's New Yorker magazine. Good evening and welcome, Dan Baum.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you. Dan, we're just hearing from Charles Hoge and Matthew Friedman about a very extensive study just done on returning veterans from Iraq. You've looked more broadly at the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder and in particular on the effects of killing on soldiers. The many causes for stress, but you've looked at this one in particular. Why?
Because nobody else does. I mean, we just heard Matthew Friedman talking about Holocaust survivors and disaster victims when talking about soldiers. And I respect Matthew Friedman a lot. But, you know, soldiers are not like Holocaust victims and disaster victims. They don't just receive experience and they don't just witness horror and they are not just inadvertently involved in the killing of civilians. Soldiers are sent into battle to kill. And I've been talking to combat veterans for years. And just last December, I hung out at Walter Reed Medical Center with amputees for another story I was working on. I was there for about a week talking to amputees. And they could joke about their own wounds. They could tell stories in vivid detail about having their arms and legs blown off. But when the subject came up about the killing they had done, the room would get very quiet. And I began thinking about this. And I'm not the first to think about this, but Army and Veterans Administration psychiatry does not look at the psychological effects of the killing that soldiers do. Not just the killing. They will occasionally touch on inadvertently killing other Americans. They will occasionally touch on killing prisoners or civilians. But a lot of combat veterans, by no means all, but a lot, anecdotally, will say that the thing that keeps them up at night years later are the faces of the people that they killed, even enemy soldiers with weapons in their hands. And this is not to indict the Army or the VA. I think those institutions care about the people that they minister to. And I think this current study is really interesting because it did, for the first time, ask soldiers specifically about killing that they did. That's a first. But by and large, soldiers tell me that, you know, and the Army and the VA tell me that it just isn't talked about. That Army and VA psychiatry is largely geared toward the receipt of terrible experience in combat. You saw terrible things. You were very scared. You lost your friends. But soldiers tell me when they try to talk to their VA and Army shrinks about, hey, I killed this guy and I'm flipping out about it, often they're told, soldier, you did your duty. And there are reasons for it. And this is not to indict these institutions, but this is how it is.
But of course, killing is exactly what countries ask soldiers to do when they send them into battle.
Exactly.
Charles Hoge, let me turn this to you, if I may, just for a moment. What did you find in your recent survey? Many causes for post-traumatic stress disorder. But of course, as Dan Baum says, American soldiers are asked to be ready to and to kill as a significant part of what they do in war. How prominent was that in what you saw as a source of post-service distress?
Well, we're still looking at the specific correlates with post-traumatic stress symptoms, but we looked at a range of different types of experiences, and the experience of being responsible for the death of an enemy or being responsible potentially even for the death of a civilian was one of the things that we looked at. But there are a number of different factors that can contribute to post-traumatic stress symptoms. It's important, I just want to point out that it's important that from the standpoint of the types of experiences that these soldiers have had, I think it's important to understand that post-traumatic stress symptoms are in some respects a very normal, common, frequent reaction among soldiers coming back.
A normal reaction to a very abnormal situation.
Exactly. And that it's nothing to be ashamed of, to receive treatment for, et cetera. And
I think we're all on the same page with you there. Everyone's come around to that.
If I may interject here, if you look at the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder in the DSM-IV, which is the diagnostic and statistical manual for the psychiatric community that diagnoses disorders, it too talks about only about, you believed your life was in danger, you were in a terrible situation. It's all about passive receipt of experience that could be applied to a rape victim, to a tornado victim, to a civilian caught in war. There is a startling lack of scholarship on what killing does to soldiers emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. It just doesn't exist. As one high-ranking Army psychiatrist said, she kind of winced when I talked to her about it. She said, well, you've stumbled upon the dead elephant in the living room that nobody wants to talk about. And a retired Army psychiatrist said, we can't do it. If we pathologize killing, we start to consider the damage that killing does to our own soldiers, we may not be able to send them to do it. We can't go there.
Because it's in conflict with the fundamental mission of a military.
Exactly. So it makes a certain amount of sense, but it leaves our veterans high and dry.
I'd like to say something.
Matthew Friedman.
I really don't agree with you. I can't speak for what military psychiatrists discuss with their clients, but you're absolutely wrong that the VA psychiatrists don't talk about killing. And one of the examples that I gave earlier on was about killing civilians, killing other people in Iraq. So I think you've taken my statement a little bit out of context, and you're just wrong that for many, I mean, you're wrong in some of your statements about what happens in VA mental health settings. I agree with you entirely. Many of the major trauma that people with PTSD talk about who have been soldiers is the fact, because what is unique about a soldier and perhaps about a police officer and a few other people is that not only might they be the recipients of trauma, but they're also inflicting it. And it really is a conundrum, and it's one of the reasons why many of us feel that treating military people with PTSD is more difficult, because of the fact that there is the perpetration aspect for some of these people, not for all of them by any stretch of the imagination. So I really think you're making some global statements that are not true.
The VA and the DOD recently put out two editions of a clinician's guide to the Iraq War vet. This is a guide for clinicians dealing with Iraq War veterans. The latest edition is 200 pages long. It does not mention killing as a stressor. It talks about killing in the context of it may be difficult for the clinician to work with these soldiers because the clinician himself might have a problem dealing with people who have killed. It touches very briefly on the killing of civilians, but it goes on for 200 pages and doesn't ever acknowledge that soldiers might be disturbed by the killing that they've done.
Charles Hogan,
I find that weird and borderline negligent. And when I ask Colonel Tom Burke, who's the highest-ranking mental health official in the Pentagon, why that was, he looked at me blankly and said, I don't have a good answer for you.
Dan Bound, let me put this to Charles Hogue, who's just brought back some new results from this study. And Charles Hogue, I found some of these elements striking. Perhaps they speak to what Dan Baum's raising. Perhaps not. You tell us. But there seemed to be almost a kind of straight line relationship between the amount of active firefight a soldier had seen and the rate of post-traumatic stress disorder. You found, 4.5% for veterans who had experienced no firefights, 9.3% for those who had seen one or two, 12.7% for 3 to 5, and for soldiers who had been in more than five firefights, 19.3%, the highest. That would seem to have something to do with killing.
Yeah, I think there's clearly a number of factors that contribute to symptoms of post-traumatic stress, and I think that there's been a lot of discussion about one stressor, a big one, but I think that there's other factors, being fired upon, firing at the enemy, handling or uncovering human remains on the battlefield. These were experiences that many of these soldiers had. Having a buddy injured or killed who you're close to is a tremendous stressor. Also, having a close call where you yourself are injured or nearly injured, but maybe the protective gear saved you. All of these are potential stressors which are important to look at and which we are looking at. And I think that one of the fundamental purposes of our study is to really understand what are the predictors of post-traumatic stress symptoms, which of these are most important, and how best do we reach service members and provide the very best care that we can. And I think it's important to look at each and every one of these, not focus necessarily just on one.
Charles Hoag, Dan Baum, Matthew Friedman, stand by. I want to begin to welcome our callers in tonight. Michael is calling from Hazel Green, Wisconsin. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
How are you?
Just fine, thanks. Thanks for calling.
I had called in because I was listening to your show, and I'm a 15-year police veteran, and there's a lot of parallels between the law enforcement side of the house and the military side of the house. And one of the things that I was talking with one of your representatives about was that Colonel Grossman had done a considerable amount of work interviewing Vietnam vets, and he's written a book called On Killing. And basically what that dealt with was the psychological impact of vets, specifically from Vietnam, dealing with the issue of killing and the psychological trauma associated with that. And basically, he had related that over to law enforcement about how officers are engaged with deadly use of deadly force.
Michael, let me ask you something. How do you compare, if you have a means to compare, the treatment that police officers get after that kind of interaction and that U.S. military get?
From what I can tell you is that a lot depends from the law enforcement side of the house on the agency involved. Different agencies will handle things differently. I think one of the things that the military has done really well, and having some experience being in the Army myself, was that the military is now learning to take much better care of its soldiers. But this is an issue that it really truly needs to be addressed on both sides of the house. And a lot is dependent, it's circumstantial-based as far as law enforcement goes.
And what kind of treatment they get and where they are and what happens to be available in that community. Michael, thanks for your call. Dan Baum, you quote Dave Grossman that Michael refers to and his book On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. He's pretty critical. I don't want to focus only on this issue tonight, but it is an important one.
It is, and he teaches at West Point. There's a philosophy professor at West Point named Peter Kilner who talks about this issue too. Both of them military men who are trying to get the military to talk more about this. You know, obviously killing is not the only stressor in combat, but it's the only one that's not discussed and it's not written about. It's not – you know, you pick up the Army manuals, the combat leader's manual to combat stress. Killing isn't mentioned. It doesn't come up. You look in the big 500-page textbook, War Psychiatry, that the Army uses. Killing is not listed as a stressor. Even though way buried way back in there on page 300 and something, there's a paragraph that says soldiers report that killing the enemy is the most stressful thing they do. And yet on page one, when there's a big chart of stressors, killing isn't among them.
And yet they're going to have to deal with it.
How
does an army deal with something like that? That's central to the mission
very often. It may be that the army can't deal with it. And I'm not here to call the Army or the VA villains. War is the villain. I mean, you send people in to do this, you got to expect it to torque their souls in a very deep and profound way.
Matthew Friedman, can you speak to that for us, please?
Yes, I'd like to point out that all of the research that's been done on veterans, dating back to the National Vietnam Veterans study done 20 years ago, killing, all the things that Mr. Baum was talking about are included in all of the instruments to measure traumatic stress, as was done by Dr. Hoag in his study. So,
Dr. Hoag in his study, but it was not done earlier.
The way that traumatic exposure was assessed. There are always a lot of questions about this, a lot of the research that I've been engaged in and other people have been doing for 20 years. So this is not a secret, not in terms of the people who have been trying to understand PTSD and understand the magnitude of the symptoms that occur as a result of the stressors.
Matthew Friedman, let me ask you a layman's question about it. Then what is the best way to prepare soldiers for the fact that they may have to inflict death, may well have to, as part of their duty? What's the best training in advance for them to deal with that psychologically once it's done?
Well, I think the best way to deal with any major stressor is preparation. The best, the more that they know what to expect, the more that they have an opportunity to explore these things. And again, if what Mr. Baum is saying about that I would defer to Dr. Hoag on this, that the Army doesn't prepare people for this, then clearly that's not the best preparation. People need to know what to expect under extreme situations. They know what to expect in a war zone. They need to know what's going to happen to them, how they might react, because with that kind of preparation, they're in a much better position to cope with it appropriately and not to develop PTSD or some other post-war zone problem.
Dan Baum, a final thought from you on this issue. What did you learn about the best way to prepare? Tell us.
You know, the Army's mission is not to protect the long-term mental health of its soldiers. The Army's mission is to win wars and keep its soldiers alive. And those are enormous responsibilities. And officers are very clear, killing is not discussed in training. And in fact, training is now designed to make killing as abstract as possible for soldiers. They put fire out, but even sniper school, they never use the word kill. It just is not discussed, and the Army can give very good reasons why they don't do it. They say, we want people to react instinctively and quickly. We don't want people weighing moral questions in combat because it might get them killed if they hesitate.
And yet sooner or later, soldiers are humans, and they have to deal with all of war, including
It is not the Army's job to look after the long-term mental health of its soldiers. It's got to win wars and get them home alive and in one piece, and that's enough of a responsibility.
I'm hearing another message here tonight. We'll look at it. Dan Baum, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Dan Baum, author of The Price of Valor in this week's New Yorker magazine. He joined us tonight from KAZU Studios in Pacific Grove, California. We're talking about the psychological price of a war, about post-traumatic stress disorder and U.S. troops returning from Iraq. How do we get our soldiers to talk about realities that are so uncomfortable for us to hear and for them to relive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the psychological price of a war, about post-traumatic stress disorder, and U.S. troops returning from Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. What is the country's obligation to the hearts and minds of returning vets? And if killing is the most traumatic act, what's a soldier to do? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Were you there? What have you brought home? was a son or daughter, a husband or wife of yours there. What have they brought home? How are they dealing with it? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Silver Spring, Maryland, by Colonel Charles Hoag, psychiatrist at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, and from Woodstock, Vermont, by Matthew Friedman, executive director at the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. We're joined right now from Waukesha, Wisconsin, by Ruth. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
We are in, there is a huge lag in psychological understandings of the effects of war. It goes back, way back to World War One and way before that. I've been affected by my father discharged with a normal discharge, but 5 years later, after four children, I was the oldest, he had a complete breakdown, and he tried to kill my mother, and I saw flashbacks as a child. And he was catatonic, you know, for like 5 years.
And this is after, this is a World War One veteran, your father.
World War One veteran. Nobody talked about all this.
Wow.
They had very little treatment at the VA hospital. I'd visit him, and nobody talked about what was really going on. We are in such denial about the violence of war and its psychological effects. You can hear I'm very emotional about this.
And yet, Ruth, after Vietnam and everything the country's seen, don't you share the feeling that the conversation is, at least one hopes, more open than it was after World War One?
Well, yeah, it's slowly evolving. Thank God.
Ruth, it's a terrible story. Thank you for sharing it with us. Charles Hoag, can you describe the evolution of understanding and treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder in the military for us? And what about treatment and where it's come today?
Well, I think we've learned a lot. As Dr. Friedman pointed out, we did not problem of post-traumatic stress disorder really hadn't been characterized at the time of Vietnam, and it wasn't until a number of years after Vietnam that the diagnosis was really first characterized, well characterized, and then a variety of studies were conducted. I think we've come a long way. We have very good treatments available, FDA-approved medications that are safe and reliable and have very minimal side effects.
And what kinds of medications?
Things like the serotonin reuptake inhibitors in the same class as Prozac. Prozac is probably the most well-known, but the two that are approved for use are Zoloft and Paxil.
And is that a temporary palliative, or is it something that someone suffering from this disorder is going to have to take for many years?
I think from a public health standpoint, the prognosis is really much better the earlier that a person comes in for treatment. And I think that we're not just talking about medications, but there's a variety of different types of psychotherapy that are effective for PTSD. And the hope is that the earlier someone comes in, the better off they'll be in the long run and prevent chronicity from developing or prevent more severe symptoms.
And Dr. Friedman, when the U.S. military looked back at the Vietnam experience and that 30% plus rate of post-traumatic stress disorder, was that seen as a fiasco, as a disaster? Did that light a fire under all the treatment efforts?
I don't think there's any way to overestimate the importance of that study. It was the first time that any nation had systematically attempted to understand the psychiatric impact of being in a war zone. I think people were quite surprised by the 30% number. What that means for all the listeners is 30% of all male veterans, 25% of all females who were in Vietnam had PTSD at some point in their lives. At the point of the study, roughly half of the men had no longer had PTSD. They about 15%, and about two-thirds of the women had gotten better by that time. But many of them were still quite symptomatic. It was another 30% that had what we call subsyndromal PTSD, where they didn't quite have the full syndrome. But the importance of the study, I think, was it was a wake-up call to everybody that having these problems is quite considerable, and that there is a great risk to putting people, men and women, in this kind of a situation. I frankly also, I'm sorry that Mr. Baum isn't still here, because I disagree with what he said about the U.S. military not caring about the mental health of its soldiers. I think it does for the usual reasons, but also psychiatric attrition of troops, people that can no longer carry out their duties because of their psychiatric problems, is very costly to the military. They don't want to lose any good men and good women. So I think that there are economic reasons as well as the other usual kinds of reasons why the military does care very much about the mental health of its men and women.
Dan Baum wrote, and this amazed me, that during the Second World War, the U.S. military lost more frontline soldiers to psychological collapse than to death by enemy fire. That was astounding to me.
And he's correct in that. That's one of his statements with which I agree.
But let me ask you this. Is it possible for a military, for a country, to really pick up the psychological cost of warfare? Or is it just inevitable that soldiers, some significant portion, are going to come back wounded and with something lost that cannot be regained?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, war is not good for people. People suffer. They lose limbs, and they also lose their mental equilibrium, and sometimes they lose both. And I think that is a cost, and I think it's one of the reasons why the decision to go to war is such an important one in terms of the human personnel. I mean, we've had 1,000 casualties in Iraq already, maybe five times that many psychiatric casualties in terms of people that have, they've survived, but they've survived in
they're
ways
wounded.
That they have changed them in major ways.
And I wonder, Charles Hogue, you have done the study in part to encourage people to come forward, and yet isn't there, in fact, still a stigma? We've just got a minute left, but we all heard the story last year of the Army staff sergeant who had seen a mutilated Iraqi body. He told his unit's combat stress officer, and he asked to be sent back to the U.S. He was charged with cowardly conduct that was later reduced and ultimately dismissed. But isn't there reason that soldiers fear being stigmatized?
I think there's actually there certainly may be anecdotal situations like what you describe, but I think overall the leadership is really taking a very proactive approach to try to encourage help seeking. I think there are a number of barriers. It's a challenge that we have to really try to destigmatize mental health problems and encourage folks to come in. Mental health, when you talk about help seeking, males don't seek mental health services anywhere near as frequently as females do when they have mental health concerns. And I think that combined with the military is primarily a male organization, and so it's not an organization of people who are going to seek help necessarily for mental health concerns when they have them. Getting the message out there that these are normal, expected reactions for which there's very good treatment that will not impact someone's career, that have minimal side effects, is a very important message for people to hear.
We've got that message tonight. I want to be sure to get this on the air. The hotline, a confidential civilian counseling for soldiers who may have post-traumatic stress disorder, 1-800-464-8107, and you can get it at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Charles Hogue at Walter Reed Institute, Army Institute of Research, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Matthew Friedman at the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Do I have time to mention our website?
Very quickly.
www.nccptsd for National Center for PTSD.org. Lots of information about PTSD. And
we've got it. Find it on the web. This is On Point. $868 American service members have died in Iraq since the start of the war there nearly a year and a half ago now. Remarkably, none of the casualties had occurred in the unit of Roman Diaz, son of On Point contributor Sue Diaz, during its first year in Iraq. But that lucky streak came to an end recently when a roadside bomb killed 24-year-old Sergeant Jeremy Horton. Horton was supposed to have returned home to Erie, Pennsylvania, in May before the Defense Department decided to extend his stay at the last minute. The news that someone in her son's company had been killed hit Sue Diaz hard. In this radio diary, she recalls the day she learned of Horton's death and wonders what effect his loss is having on the soldiers of the unit he left behind.
Late at night, somewhere near Baghdad, my son sat typing on an Army computer. Through the miracle of instant messaging, his words, as he typed them, appeared on the screen of the laptop. their sister's bedroom in Northern California, where it was mid-morning. I was relaxing with a book on the couch in her living room in the middle of a four-day visit and could hear the intermittent click, click, click of their online conversation. Back and forth it went, punctuated suddenly by a soft gasp from Anne and a whispered, "Oh, no." My husband stopped in his tracks in the hallway near her door. "What?" I heard him ask her. And then, "When?" I heard the answers, too. So when our soldier added a little while later, "Don't tell Mom, okay? She'll only worry more," it was too late for Anne to keep her brother's secret. I already knew that a few hours earlier a roadside bomb killed Sergeant Jeremy Horton of Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 6th Infantry Regiment, my son's unit. And in that same explosion, another soldier lost a leg, and still another, an eye. I thought back to how, in recent months, he had told us that his company had developed a reputation for being invincible. "Bridges blow up after we cross them," he boasted then. "Mortars land in barracks we just left." Unlike other companies of the 1st Armored Division, my sons hadn't lost a single infantryman in all the time they'd been on the ground in Iraq, nearly a year. But in one red and black instant, Bravo's reputation, like the vehicle its Sergeant Horton had been riding in, had been blown to bits. My son's squad of eight hadn't been assigned to the convoy that night, and when the bad news came, he told his sister with what I can only surmise must have been an incredulous shake of his head. He had been reading a magazine back at the base. And knowing that I'm not supposed to know any of this, I let my imagination fill in the blanks that Google and CNN.com can't. And I imagine, not so much the immediate aftermath of smoke, metal, and bodies, it's just too hard to go there, but the quieter aftermath of the days and weeks to come. What is it like, I wonder, for the soldiers who saw the whole thing happen in a side-view mirror on that road near Al-Askandariya, or for the ones who heard the news over a cup of mess hall coffee, or while trying to forget the war for a couple hours with a DVD or a magazine. Before this, when I'd read headlines like U.S. soldiers killed in attack, I never really considered the ripple effect on those they'd been serving with. It was only natural to focus on the fallen and their families, and not on those other soldiers who would open their eyes the next morning to see an empty cot across the way. But I'm thinking about them now. And those thoughts take me to their barracks, where I'm watching the soldier whose job it is to gather up Jeremy Horton's things. I see him tuck a couple of unopened envelopes into the stack of well-worn letters in the sergeant's footlocker, and watch as he removes snapshots of family and friends tacked to a wall near the cot. The soldier, all business up until this point, just sits for a while after taking down the last photo. A smiling 20-something woman leaning against a uniformed shoulder. I envision an inscription in the corner of that picture. "To my husband," it says, "with love." Most of Sergeant Horton's things will be packed up and sent to his wife, Christy, in Erie, Pennsylvania. Some of the stuff, cookies, chocolate bars, and that last carton of cigarettes, will be shared with his brothers on the base. "Horton would have wanted you to have these," I hear a squad leader say as he hands a box of Marlboros to a private notorious for bumming smokes. And one of those cigarettes glows between his fingers a few nights later as that private heads out toward his unit's Humvee. He's been saying he plans to quit smoking, probably next week. But he's not thinking about that now. Instead, in these minutes before he and his buddies go out on another mission, he can't help but think about what happened the Friday before, about the people in his company who are no longer there, and about others who live half a world away. Gazing up at a star-filled sky, he takes one last drag of Sergeant Horton's Marlboro, and at that same moment, a young widow in Pennsylvania lets out the deepest of sighs.
Sue Diaz is a regular contributor to On Point. Her son Roman is a specialist with the Army's 1st Armored Division currently serving in Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.